Hi, I'm Malcolm Hawker, and this is the CDO Matters podcast, the show where I dig deep into the strategic insights, best practices, and practical recommendations that modern data leaders need to help their organizations become truly data-driven. Tune in for thought-provoking discussions with data, IT, and business leaders to learn about the CDO matters that are top of mind for today's chief data officers. Welcome to the CDO Matters podcast. I'm Malcolm. I'm your guide, your Sherpa, your host on today's episode. It's just going to be me flying solo. I haven't done one of these in a while. It's probably been about 20 or plus episodes-ish where I haven't, where I've been just going guest after guest after guest, which is great, which is amazing. But today, it's going to be me and me alone because it's a special episode. This is our 2025 year in review, top trends in data and analytics. These episodes are fun. I do these every year. And I do the kind of what was the retrospective, the year in review type stuff. And then I'll do another one probably in 2 weeks from now, if not maybe 4 weeks, probably 2 weeks, where we're going to talk about top predictions for 2026. What I see coming around the corner. It's that time of year. Right. It's that time of year. We're getting towards the end of the year. So these kind of retroactive things, these retrospectives, they're natural and they're fun. Help us take some stock. Help us maybe learn some lessons about what we should be doing differently. Maybe take a moment to celebrate about some of the things that we did well. That's an important part of, I think, the holiday season, which is nigh, which is upon us. We'll air this episode probably the 22nd of December-ish. So with that, happy holidays, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, happy Kwanzaa, happy your chosen way to celebrate with friends and family, because that's what it's all about. Getting together, giving thanks, being together, celebrating with friends, with family, taking a moment away from the daily grind and just being and celebrating and hanging out. And maybe watching football. That's a big American thing. Canadians don't do that. We don't watch football. We watch hockey. Maybe catching a great game. Hopefully, maybe get to see your hometown team play. My beloved Edmonton Oilers are playing okay this year. Will they get to a third straight Stanley Cup final? I don't know. Got to solve the net mining problem, but I'm probably talking to an audience of like three here, other folks from Edmonton who are excited by the Oilers' progress. But you didn't turn into this podcast to listen to a hockey commentary. You came to talk about data or to listen about somebody talking about data. That's yours truly. We're going to do that today. We're going to talk about the year that was. Well, what a year. Boy, when I look back, look at some of the macro forces, like kind of a little tenuous, not bad, but not great either. Really kind of just maybe treading water. You know, I think we started the year with a lot of maybe excitement, potentially with a new administration coming in. Excitement for some, excitement for like 51% of the country, 49% dread. And there's been, you know, I think some things are certainly a little better, right? I think some of the macro high-level economic forces, there's signs that things are slowly getting better. You know, interest rates are starting to slowly come down. There's some signs the economy is doing okay. If you factored out all the spending on data centers and AI, maybe the story wouldn't be so rosy, but the spending is there. If you look, you know, beyond the Mag 7, are companies doing well? They're not doing amazing, but they're not struggling either. I think there's a lot to be positive about 20. When looking back in 2025, this is in North America. You know, Europe, I think is in a little bit more of a tenuous position. You know, high energy costs, other issues going on at a macro level in Europe, I think are making our friends overseas a little more conservative. Spending is a little tighter. Over there, that's certainly been what I've seen. I was in Europe six times this year, five or six, I think is my estimate. A lot. you know, there's wars are happening a lot closer over there. You know, what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Gaza. Still, you know, obviously a lot closer than North America. So I think those things have a little bit more of a palpable effect when it comes to the economy, when it comes to optimism about the world and about the way things are. So when I look at 2025 at a very, very high level, a macro level, okay, right? That's kind of like my it's okay, right? I got a 6 out of 10, right? Wasn't a train wreck. We didn't fall into deep recession at all. A lot of people were talking about that. Certainly a lot of people were talking about that as a result of tariffs. Remains to be seen. I think some of the impacts there are long tail impacts, but things didn't go completely sideways, right? At least from a corporate perspective, companies seem to be doing okay. Companies continue to invest in data and analytics. Companies are investing in AI. They're investing in software and technology and services. But are they investing, you know, the way that they did, you know, say 3 or 4 years ago? Probably not, right? But things I think are generally okay. Now, when it comes to the finances of individual families, I think there's a lot to be concerned about. You know, inflation remains relatively high. Employment does remain, unemployment remains reasonably low. So that's pretty good. But costs are, boy, they're high. They are high. Childcare costs, housing costs, energy costs, fuel costs, food costs. My goodness. Have you been in a grocery store recently? Wow. So yeah, again, not horrible per se, big picture. People have jobs, but there's certainly some things to be concerned about. And that's what I'm going to walk away from 2025 with I started the year optimistic. And I remain cautiously optimistic. I see good things on the horizon. That's my nature. And I certainly see good things on the horizon in the data and analytics space. There's a lot of things to be very optimistic about. I think we are in a little bit of a trough of disillusionment around AI. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Trough of disillusionment is a Gartner term. It's the Gartner hype cycle. I think last year, maybe arguably we were peak hype on Gen AI, and I think we've kind of come down. I think there's a bit more to go. I think there's more trough when it comes to Gen AI. I think there's more doom and gloom. There's more negative headlines around overspending bubbles. So I think we're most certainly in a trough. Excuse me, but what's on the other side of the trough? The path of enlightenment, the plateau of productivity, as my old employer Gartner would call it. So I do think that in 2026, this gets into my predictions, we'll start to see more real returns from investments in Gen AI. Will some companies continue to overspend? Of course. Will the spending on infrastructure be matched by returns? Probably not. Right. I think that we will continue to be underwater when it comes to high level, macro level investments in AI. And that's to be expected. Same thing happened with the internet. So I think there are reasons to be optimistic about 2026 when it comes to AI. I think there's reasons to be optimistic from a economic perspective with interest rates coming down. There'll be more money pumped into the system. I don't think prices are going to go down. I just think people will have more money in their pockets, so it won't feel as bad, right? It won't sting as much as it does to cut that check for your annual healthcare insurance. So I think 2026 is going to be a little brighter than 2025. That's my prognostication. However, tune in 2 weeks, my friends, for a full review of what's up and coming in 2026. With that, let's talk about our top 10 trends in data and analytics for 2025. Numero uno in French, is what I call the Gen AI paradox. This is something that is both easily explainable and rather unexplainable. And what do I mean by the Gen AI paradox? Well, I've touched on this in some of the stuff already. The paradox is that everybody says we're in a bubble. 95% of AI POCs are failing. Nobody's getting any tangible returns on investments from investments in no meaningful ROI right? Plenty of pithy stats that are being tossed around about how Gen AI is this overpriced parlor trick. That's one end of this paradoxical spectrum. The other end of the paradoxical spectrum is everybody's using it. Right? Like, everybody's using it. I use ChatGPT more than Google now, right? But Gemini actually in Google pretty darn good. But everybody's using it. Kids are using it to do their homework. Every marketer I know is using it. Every technology person is using some sort of copilot in GitHub. Using it to write code. Every HR person I know is using it to review and write job postings. So, you know, everybody is using it. Deloitte, McKinsey, EY, BCG, pick your big consultant. They're all talking 80 to 90% adoption. This, my friends, is the paradox. Widespread, rampant use, arguably the fastest adoption of any technology, including the internet, ever. And we're in a bubble. How can these things be concurrently true? Well, the answer is our biggest opportunity for 2026. This technology clearly has value. The value is being articulated in its use. When people use something, they're getting value from it. And if there was no value, they wouldn't use it. Right? It's that simple. So there's value here. The challenge for us as data and analytics leaders, for CDOs, is to find ways to extract more of that value and to institutionalize processes here, right? To find ways to re-engineer our core business processes, procure to pay, quote to cash. Maybe they're internal, re-engineering our data management processes, re-engineering our ETL, re-engineering our data quality processes, our governance processes, right? There are so many opportunities here, my friends. And this paradox that is my number one trend of the year suggests that there's a lot of work to be done because there's value in these technologies because people are using them, which means as the data people, we're the data people, right? It falls on us to find ways to operationalize these things at scale within our organizations. Excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. Don't know why. Maybe it's because I've been talking all morning. Shocker, I know. That is my top trend of the year, this paradox. It befuddles me and excites me. It befuddles me in that it exists and excites me in that I know that there's work that we can do and I know that there are things that we can be doing to overcome the Gen AI paradox. All right, that's number one. Number two, and I am looking at some notes here. And I use a pithy phrase to describe this. I call it the BI deer in the AI headlights. This is my trend number two. And this is a trend that I say and share with great trepidation. I don't want it to be true. I don't want trend number two to be true, but it's true. And I know it's true because I talk to people at conferences across the world, sometimes on a near weekly basis, often 2-3 times a week, right? Where I'm going to these conferences and I'm talking to people. I'm having the conversations at the lunch table and at the cocktail hour and within the conference sessions or when I'm visiting my clients, right? When I'm going on site. I was just on site last week at a large client talking about some of these issues. These issues, this number two here, top trend number two is paralysis. It is many and far too many data leaders taking a bit of a wait and see when it comes to Gen AI and the adoption of AI writ large, whether that's generative or it is more potentially predictive, machine learning, all AI. What I see is a trend of many sitting and kind of just letting things shake out, right? Where usage of Gen AI in the desktop is enough of a win for that CDO to claim, you know, a win. Or maybe the CDO has bought some technology or integrated some technology where AI is a key enabling capability within that technology, where the acquisition of technology that uses AI is enough for the CDO to say, yeah, I checked the AI box this year. I'm doing enough around AI. And that's a bit of a disturbing trend. Why? Because we desperately need to be adapting our operating models. We desperately need to be finding ways to drive value for our customers. We desperately need to change how we approach data quality, data governance, master data management, all the things. We need to change how we operate. The foundations we have are not the foundations we need when it comes to generative AI. These are two very, very different things. The foundations we've spent decades and millions of dollars building to enable accurate measurement, dashboards, reports, insights, largely, are not the foundations we need to provide accurate, consistent, reliable systems of meaning. Measurement versus meaning. This is going to be something I talk a lot about in 2026, the world of measurement and the world of meaning. We need both. Our dashboards aren't going away. Our CFO is not going to stop wanting consolidated customer transaction reports, right? We're not going to stop having financial reports. We're not going to stop any of that stuff. That still remains true. But the world of Gen AI is a very different world, right? It requires different foundations, different perspectives. It requires context. It requires highly adaptive forms of governance, meaning context-aware and context-centric forms of governance, right? We need to be doing knowledge graphs. We need to be doing more in the world of what is known as knowledge management, not data management. So these worlds necessarily must start to come together, and we must get out of this paralysis state. We must, because it's going to take time. It's going to take time, my friends, for our organizations to re-architect, to retool, to recalibrate for this world of Gen AI. It's not going away. The reason why it's not going away is because people keep using this stuff. And as long as our CEOs are using this stuff and are doing it and are getting value from it, there will be pressure for us to operationalize at scale across all of our internal processes, across all of our internal domains, functions, departments, units, whatever you call them. So the paralysis must stop. We need to get into, and we need to not be afraid of POCs. Just because 95% of them are failing doesn't mean that we shouldn't be learning. We must be learning. This is the thing that drives me the most nuts about that whole 95% of POC failing thing. It seems to be suggesting that it's not worthwhile to learn, because it is worthwhile to learn. It is. I wrote an entire book about this. And if you haven't read my book, The Data Hero Playbook talks about what is needed to adapt to this world of AI. And what is needed is what is called a growth mindset. Growth mindset embraces the idea that learning is paramount. Development is paramount. Breaking free of the status quo is what we must do. How we do that is by thinking differently, operating differently, looking at our customers, our roles, and our data in a different way. How do you do that? Well, you do some POCs. You go sit down and talk with your customers. You learn your business processes. You become business consultants. You embrace product management as a discipline within your data function. These are all things I talk about in my book. I would invite you to check it out. I think you will find it insightful. So that's number two, paralysis. The BI deer in the AI headlights, not something I want to say as a trend, but it is most certainly a trend. But we can break free, and we must break free. This will be the story of 2026. As we start to march towards the plateau of productivity and get out of this trough of disillusionment. Number three, top trend number three. In a world of chaos and disruption and paralysis, thank goodness for data products. Woohoo! Data products. Data products are the Robin to the AI Batman. Data products are the bridesmaids and bridegrooms, right, to the married couple. They are, thankfully, they're there. And thankfully, we have them. And thankfully, so many companies are focused on them, because they are actually, I think now, data products are slowly starting to work up that plateau of productivity. I think if you talk to any of the analyst firms, including my old employer, I think they'll tell you that upwards of 60-70% of companies are now embracing some form of data products. Now, I don't want to get into a prolonged discussion about the fact that we still don't have a single definition of data products, because you know what? Who cares? It's fine. I think there's a better way to do it. I think the best way is to embrace data product management. Forget the shift left, forget the shift right, forget the shifting, stop shifting, focus on customers. Focus on product management. Product thinking, at least from a data mesh perspective, is not enough. Product management thinking is what you need. Trust me on this, my friends. data products, I think, are yielding some results for companies. I think they are actually to the point, this is the story of 2025 to me, data products went from conceptual to mainstream. And I think many companies are starting to see some benefits from them, particularly those companies that are really, really, really focused on customer success. And what do I mean by customer? The people who are using the data products. I'm not talking external customers, although I'm not talking external customers. They could certainly be external to your organization. The people who use your insights, who use your dashboards, who use your KPIs, who use your APIs, whatever. Those are our customers, and we all have them. And thank goodness in 2025 that while many are struggling with AI, many are getting value from data products. So I think this is one of the success stories of 2025, that some companies started to see value from data products. Some companies who may have even started with technology, who may have even started with a data catalog and built maybe even a data catalog field of dreams, right? Like if we build it, they will come. I think some of those companies are starting to see benefit there, right? That are actually focused on use cases, that are focused on outcomes, that are focused on customer success and customer value. Many of them are articulating that through a data catalog, right? Where people are actually able to go in and search customer master and are able to pull back a gold master customer record, then actually use that to create some dashboards. Or maybe they're actually able to pull the dashboard back itself to see their customer report for the last month. So I am starting to see some real tangible value being delivered from data products, and that's a good thing. Data products exist on a spectrum. They are shift left. They're also shift right. They are built specifically for customers, but they also enable scale. Sometimes as they enable scale, sometimes they're customized for a specific customer, right? And both are valid. Sometimes you need raw materials, right? If you have customers out there who are comfortable building their own dashboards, fantastic. Get them some raw materials. That's great. But then there are other customers who want a bow around their product. They want a finished product, right? There are plenty of customers that will pay a lot of money for a very customized, bespoke, one-off product, right? If everything we do was always about scale and high volume and low cost, well, then we wouldn't have luxury cars, right? Like there's nothing scalable about the process of building a Lamborghini, right? Where every part is hand machined, right? Or a McLaren, right? Sometimes our customers have a lot of money. Sometimes they want a very customized one-off product. And that's okay. If they're willing to pay for it and they're and we're solving a specific customer problem, we should be okay with building it that way. If it's economically viable. This, my friends, is what product management can deliver to us. Product management will tell us, are we doing something in a way that is economically viable? Sometimes the best economic viability will be to shift left. Sometimes it'll be to shift right. There's no wrong answer. It's both. And 2025, to me, one of the top stories is some people are starting to realize this when it comes to data products. And I'm optimistic that we'll see even more of this in 2026. I'm seeing and hearing more people talk about product management. I'm hearing more people talk about data products. I'm hearing more people talk about tangible value from data products. That is a success story of 2025. Hip, hip, hooray. More of those, please. Number four. I should have sound effects. Number four, and I title this, The Problems and Opportunities of Unstructured Data. In 2025, we finally, 2+ years after the launch of ChatGPT, we finally started to figure out, finally, that the data that Gen AI wants is unstructured, right? Throw a table into a prompt, good luck, right? Gen AI doesn't want a table, right? Gen AI has a hard time consuming the intersection of a row and a column because there's no context. Gen AI wants a narrative. Gen AI wants a story. Gen AI wants context. There is very little context in a table, right? There's actually even arguably very little context in a complete ERD, right? Yeah, I can understand that customers are related to products which are located to locations, but that's about as basic as it comes. right? And that's still not enough. The best prompts are the prompts that are rich with context, that are rich with insights, that are rich with narrative. And the more that is given to Gen AI, the better the results are going to be. This is this whole issue of the foundations we have are not the foundations we need. But we finally, in 2025, here's another success story of 2025. We finally started to figure out, because I've been pounding this drum for literally 3 years straight. Pounding it. And what do I mean? I've been pounding the unstructured data drum. We need to focus on unstructured data. Unstructured data, we need to focus on this. We need to govern it. We need to steward it. We need to oversee it. We need to manage it. We need to get our hands around it. You can call it however you want to call it. But the days of ignoring 80 to 90% of our enterprise data, and that's Gartner's estimates, 80 to 90% of our data is unstructured, sitting in SharePoint servers, PDFs, CAD files, semi-structured in JSON and XML, you name it, email servers. Good grief. How much data do we have sitting in email? Woo! 80 to 90% of our data, maybe even video files, audio files. I can keep going. You get my point. 80 to 90% of our data is largely ungoverned, largely ignored by the data management function. And that must stop. And in 2025, I actually heard more people starting to talk about the need to govern unstructured data. Now, how we do that, if I were to put this on a hype cycle, I think we're kind of starting to go up the hype cycle. And I think in 2026, maybe 2027, unstructured data will start to peak from a hype perspective. We're not even close. Now we're just at an awareness stage when it comes to unstructured data. But that's a good thing. It's a good thing because it's necessary. This is a massive opportunity for data leaders and data practitioners. Massive, massive, massive. Now, a lot of this is cruft. A lot of this is junk, right? A lot of this are those old physical copies of Sports Illustrated sitting in your basement, right? Probably okay to send them to the shredder. Probably okay to archive a lot of that data, but a lot of it, my friends, will be highly useful. And how will we separate the wheat from the chaff? How will we do that? Look no further than my old friend, Master Data. Pareto principle will most certainly apply. All of that unstructured data, 80% of it is probably cruft. 80% of it, we probably don't care. 20% of it will have 80% of the value. And that 20% is data related to our customers, our products, our assets, our locations, our employees, our items, our materials. Good old Master Data that is shared widely across the organization. Herein lies a huge opportunity. How do we apply master data management disciplines to all of that unstructured data? How do we do it? How do we govern it? How do we steward it? How do we certify it as accurate, trustworthy, consistent, all the things that we've been doing for decades on unstructured data? Forgive me. How do we do that to unstructured data? It's a different model. It's a different approach. Right, how we apply governance to this data will be different. How we master, quote, quote, this data will be different. By definition, it'll have to be different. This will be something we figure out in 2026 and 2027, because now, thanks to this trend and trend number three, or was it four? Look at my notes. I get so excited. That's number four. Thanks to trend number four, which is the problems and opportunities related to unstructured data, we now know that we're going to have conversations. We're going to increasingly have conversations about what does it mean to govern unstructured data? How do we do it? Do we need to break it into structure in order to govern it at scale? That's an interesting question. I think we do to a certain degree. I think we need to be able to suss out and parse out when we're referring to things that we care about, right? Master data. I think we will need to structure it to some degree, but optimally we need to maintain it in its unstructured form to make it the most valuable for Gen AI. So it's both. It's both. We need to be able to, if we were to overlay something known as the DIKW framework, data, information, knowledge, wisdom, if we use that as a guide, and we got data at the bottom of the pyramid, information, knowledge, wisdom, we started with knowledge, which is, let's say, or information, which is a narrative, a story, a paragraph of text describing maybe a customer service interaction, maybe a sales interaction. you'd ask yourself, okay, in order to govern that at scale, that paragraph, do I need to break it into pieces? Or do I need to break it in? Do I need to structure it? I think the answer is yes, but you will also need to maintain it as unstructured, because that's what Gen AI wants. Gen AI wants to eat that paragraph. It doesn't want to digest those kind of like atomic bits, right? It wants the paragraph. So we need to maintain that, but we also need to be able to say, is this accurate? Is it relevant? Is this a high quality paragraph? That's going to be hard. Data accuracy, we just had a little blip, because accuracy is contextual. Data quality is contextual. It may be accurate to a marketing use case, but maybe not accurate to a finance use case. And that's okay. These are the types of foundations we need, my friends. Those are the foundations we need. This is how we need to start looking at these challenges, these problems. So, unstructured data. We're going to need to structure some of it, but not all of it. And we're going to need to think about doing things differently. Huge opportunity for us in 2026. Top trend number 5. And I just touched on this, but this is slightly different, but very related. And top trend number 5 is the idea that context matters. Thank goodness we're having more people actually talk about context. We're having more people talk about knowledge graph. We're having more people talk about semantic layers. We're having more people talk about knowledge management. This, again, is a tie to this awareness that the intersection of a row and column is largely useless to a large language model, right? Like putting in one name into a prompt is going to yield nothing, right? Like it's going to yield nothing. Context matters, semantics matter, meaning matters, right? And we're seeing this articulate itself through increased adoption of knowledge graphs. We're seeing this in increased adoption of this idea of semantic layers. We're seeing it in increased awareness of knowledge management writ large. We're seeing this through more and more people in the data world talk about the importance of ontologies and taxonomies. So this is also a very, very good thing. Right, because these disciplines and these technologies, there's knowledge management is a discipline, and there's technologies to enable them, and there are processes which enable them. Right, so building a taxonomy, building an ontology, building a defined vocabulary, aka a business glossary or a technical glossary, doing all these things is going to be necessary to pivot. Ooh, I just hit my microphone. Pivot from our legacy foundations to the foundations we need for Gen AI. We're not getting away from the things that we've always done. Those will remain. The world of measurement will remain, right? Our CFO isn't going to just magically stop asking for financial reports. It's not going to happen. We need to continue to maintain things, the status quo of the things that we've always done, right? But we need to embrace this world of knowledge management. The connective tissue between those things, between the layer of data and the layers of data and information and knowledge, check out the DIKW pyramid. Just search it in Google. I've had my screen blip a couple of times. Hopefully it didn't blip for far too long. And we're okay. I hope we are. Screen may have gone black. I've had some internet problems here. For those of you who don't know, and I don't know why you would, for several months, I've been in major home renovation. So I'm not in my usual studio. I'm in an Airbnb down the street. And this is our third different Airbnb on our street. It's no fun moving from home to home to home. But one of the advantages of living in Florida and living in a place where people come on vacation is that there's lots of Airbnbs on your street. So at least I have a place to go. And I'm within walking distance of my home that is currently in a state of destruction, because we're renovating it. Anyway, where was I? Semantics, context, top trend 2025. More and more and more people are becoming aware and attuned to the need to add context, knowledge graphs, ontologies, taxonomies into their data management practices. So those are mishmash between technologies and disciplines. Really what I'm talking about here, my friends, is the integration of knowledge management as a discipline into the data management function. This is a must-have. It is no longer a nice-to-have. It is a must-have. It is a must-have. And if you're a chief data officer listening to this, go find the knowledge managers in your organization. They're out there. particularly if you're with a bigger company, if you're like 2 billion plus in your company, there is a knowledge management function. Trust me. They're managing internal search capabilities. They're managing content management systems, often in marketing, right? Maybe they're just even managing SharePoint, but there are people out there that are managing the system that today is housing a lot of this unstructured data. Go find them, go make friends with them, and try to build bridges into those organizations. If not, finding ways to deeply integrate them into your organization. That is something you should be doing in 2026, I think. Yeah. Advice. That was number five. That was semantics and context. Now we're coming up on number six.
Six.
Just want to check my time. I'll be spending less. These are less important trends, I think, as we get deeper into the list. One of the things I'm noticing as a trend in 2025, I saw, is what I'm just kind of calling the changing landscape of events, the changing landscape of thought leadership and events. Things are changing. And I know this is kind of unique to me because I'm going to so many darn events. Like, I go to a lot of events, but things are changing. And I think the changes that I'm seeing are very, very positive, where there's this shift from events that are primarily focused on talk at to events that are primarily focused on talk with. And this is a difference, right? Talk at, you're going to go, you're going to sit in an auditorium, somebody's going to talk at you. Somebody like me. Right? Who's going to give the PowerPoint, give the presentation. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. This is still, I think, valuable and important. And I'm definitely pro-event. Even in situations where you go to an event and 70% is stuff you already knew, but that 30% that you didn't know will make the event worthwhile. Right? Not to mention the fact you're getting away from the day-to-day. You're getting away from the grind. You're free to go think differently. You're free to go kind of get free yourself from, you know, the daily grind, and you find yourself being more creative. You find yourself being more, you know, focused on more complex problems, right? Because you give yourself space in your mind to go think about these things when maybe you're not giving yourself space to think about these things. So I'm pro event, but I'm seeing this shift towards more talk with, right? Where it's, let's get together as a smaller group. So instead of thousands of people in an auditorium, I'm seeing smaller groups to get together. Maybe it's around a dinner table. And that's cool, right? My friend Juan Cicada at ServiceNow does these honest, no BS dinners, and they're very popular. And he goes from city to city, and it's like 10 people getting together talking about stuff, right? That's the ultimate talk with, right? You've got Juan, who is one of the smartest people that I know, like whether that's data, whether that's anything, it's just one of the smartest people I know, hard stop, who is sitting down and having conversations with CIOs and CDOs and VPs of data and analytics over dinner about important stuff. Like, that's a valuable interaction where it's not just about Juan. He's just basically acting as a facilitator, right? Although he has got a ton of knowledge to share. But it's, you know, he and his sidekick, Tim, where they're going out and having these conversations. So Juan and Tim both, like, just crazy, crazy smart folks who are out there sharing what they know. But more than anything, it's getting this smaller group together where everybody is sharing what they know. That's important. That's valuable. And I'm seeing more and more of that as a trend. My recommendation to you, my friends, is to get engaged. Go out there. Say yes. You know, sometimes some of these things can be pretty salesy, right? Some of these things are, you know, they're trying to extract something from you, right? Where it's like, come, you know, it's like a timeshare, right? Come for your free dinner at Ruth's Chris, and you just have to suffer through three vendor, you know, pitches. And you know, maybe you don't want to do that, but there are opportunities to engage in some of these smaller sessions. Another good example is my friend Aaron Wilkerson and Ryan Dolly literally created their own conference called it Data in the D. They're both in Detroit. And they created a kind of user-centric, user-driven conference this year. And they have like 100 people, which is amazing. Way to go, Aaron. Way to go, Ryan. Awesome stuff, right? Maybe create your own conference, right? But find ways, get out there, get engaged. Find ways to go meet with the community. Go have conversations with other people. Even if it's just virtually, there's a plenty of these opportunities out there. I'm helping facilitate some of these, right? I'm creating some of these events. We're holding events just like this. There's other events that are kind of somewhere in the middle. A good example of that is CDO Magazine events. CDO Magazine has got some amazing events where if you're a data leader, it doesn't cost you anything. You can go, right? Yes, there's still a vendor hall. yes, vendors are still trying to sell you something because you got to pay for the hotel. You got to pay for the free lunch, right? Nothing's free. It's got to be paid for. But where it's kind of a bit of a happy medium between the, you know, the 3,000 or 4,000 people at like a Gartner event, where it's $3,000 or $4,000 a ticket, which is crazy, which is true, by the way, versus going to a free something at a local hotel where you're hanging out with a room full of CDOs. Like, that's fantastic. Do that. Go do that. Get out there, get engaged, network like there's no tomorrow. Because this is going to touch on something I'm sharing as my top trend number 10. It is in your interest to get engaged with the local data community and get engaged with these events. Number seven, convergence of tools, converging data management tools. This has been something that's been kind of slowly happening for the last few years. It really seemed to accelerate this year. And I think it's because of more mergers and acquisitions. There's plenty of examples out there. I just mentioned ServiceNow that acquired Data.World. Atlassian acquires Socata. Salesforce acquires Informatica. I think we're going to see a lot more of this in 2026. And all of these acquisitions are symptomatic of this convergence, right? This convergence of data management tools, data management platforms, but they're also symptomatic of those data management platforms aligning themselves, I think, more closely to business applications, right? ServiceNow, Salesforce, perfect examples of this, right? Where, and I think you're going to see more and more of this from business application providers, right? Like the software, the big systems of record providers, right? ERP, CRM, SCM, MAP, marketing automation platforms, where more and more of those providers integrate data management capabilities into their platforms. So there will be that world. And of course, there is the analytics world, where those providers, the Databricks, Snowflakes, Azures, are continually integrating data management platforms, data management capabilities into those platforms. So we will have two. We'll have applications, right? And we will have analytics layers. Those will be the giant schism in each of those, having more and more and more converged data management capabilities within their respective platforms. What do I mean by converged data management capabilities? Quality, MDM, integration, analytics, right? All of these things coming together where the lines between the and metadata management and governance as well, of course, where the lines between them are becoming increasingly blurry. Increasingly blurry. So where the line between a data catalog and an MDM is still there, but it's blurred. Where the line between an MDM platform and a data quality platform is blurred, or the line between data quality and metadata management platform is blurred. We've always had overlapping capabilities in this space. It's always been the case, but I think what we'll increasingly, and we are already seeing this, but we'll see more of this where there's more overlap, but where there is overlap, there is integration, right? Between those platforms, right? So instead of there being overlap, right, in a integration capability in an MDM, I think we'll start to see those things actually come together. Does this mean that there will be no longer best of breed providers? Of course not. Of course not. There will be best of breed providers that are selling standalone MDM platforms, standalone data quality platforms. But what we will see, and we're already seeing it, is where those platforms are deeply integrated at the point of capability overlap, at the point of functional overlap. MDM has data quality capabilities in it. Data catalogs have data quality capabilities in it. And when they are overlap, that is the integration point with these other providers. So you will start to see best of breed providers come together, right? Either come together or partner with, have strategic alliances with the bigger suite providers. Classic example is my employer, Prophecy. We've got a deep integration to Microsoft and we're building out additional integrations to other platforms like Databricks, which we have an integration to, and Snowflake, which we have an integration to, and build out integrations into data catalogs as well, like to have an integration into Atlan, Calibra, Alation, on and on. That is where we are going as a provider of one of these systems, and I know it's where other providers are going. So there will still be this idea of standalone. So as a buyer, as a CDO, don't be afraid. one could argue that's actually a viable form of protection against lock-in, against getting, you know, putting all of your eggs into one giant mega provider. We've seen this in the past. Doing this doesn't necessarily yield positive results. Remember Siebel? Right? When something becomes everything to everybody, maybe not necessarily the best thing. So don't be afraid of best of breed solutions, because if the people who are running the software companies are doing it the right way, they are deeply integrating to these other platforms. So the worlds are coming together. And again, why? Why are they coming together? Gen AI is a big reason. AI is a big reason, right? But cost savings are another reason. And you can try to get rid of some of these overlaps of capability. But having an integrated management platform is just a natural evolution of this space. That's top trend number 7, my friends. Number 8. Hey, this is a short one, but top trend, everybody's now an AI expert. Everybody's an AI expert. 4 years ago, in the data and analytics space, nobody was talking, very few people were talking about AI. Very few. Some people were talking about AI. But all of a sudden, now in the last 3 years, everybody's an AI expert. My friends, I am not an AI expert. I am a data management expert. Some of that actually gets into unstructured data. So it gets into the data that AI wants. But I don't know how to write an AI algorithm. I'm not a data scientist. Never have been, never claimed to be. My expertise is data management, structured and unstructured. But I'm not an AI expert, but I know what AI needs. I know what AI needs. So be wary. This isn't about me. This is about you. Be wary, whether that is a consultant, whether that is a vendor, right? Whether that is somebody you're looking to hire. Be very, very skeptical of their AI credentials, right? Because if we are to adapt, if we are to pivot, if we are to shift our foundations towards this world, we need people we can rely on. We need people we can trust. And there's a lot of people out there who have pitched a sign saying they are an expert, AI expert, talking about AI generally in the frame of platitudes. So this is a tell. I like poker. I'm not very good at it, but I like it. And that's a phrase we use in poker. It's a tell, right? If somebody's out there talking about a lot of platitudes with AI, saying things like, you know, bad data equals bad AI, and that's their primary sales pitch, for example, one of many. But if they're talking in a lot of platitudes and they actually can't get into specifics about how to change your operating model, what it means to build an actual model, what it means to manage a data estate, what it means to manage a data science function, how data science is different than general BI, right? If they can't articulate the differences between this highly probabilistic world of AI and our deterministic world of BI, if they can't get into specifics about how these things differ, if they can't explain why data scientists prefer to go to source systems instead of dealing with the output of a data quality hub or an MDM hub, if they can't talk in any detail, then are they really an AI expert? Chances are they're not. They just say they are because there's AI washing is rampant. It's rampant in the solutions that we purchase. It's rampant in the consultants that we partner with. And it's rampant in the resumes of people that you're reviewing right now. So be very, very skeptical that people have the AI pedigrees that they say they do, because we need experts. We need people we can trust. That includes me. So just be skeptical. I'm just seeing a lot of people flying an AI banner. And if you peel that onion, it doesn't take too long to figure out there's not a lot of substance there. Be wary. Number nine. Well, top trend number 9, semantic pedanticism reaches all-time high. Semantic pedanticism. This is a phrase that I coined, I think maybe 3 years ago, to define, it was kind of like a tongue-in-cheek. I did it in a LinkedIn post, and I was like, man, this actually explains a lot of things. And it was my attempt to explain really kind of two things. One is, why do we keep inventing new words to describe old things? Like we are incessant about just new words, right? Like data literacy, good grief. Just call it training. Please call it training. But we created a new phrase, data literacy. We do it all the time. So that's kind of one phenomenon. And the other phenomenon is we fall down these rabbit holes of meaning and we argue and bicker constantly about the meaning of things. We talk about the meaning of things all the time, and we tend to be rather tribal, right? We tend to be these, when we fall down these rabbit holes, we get into arguments about how to define things like semantics. Like one of the most meta LinkedIn posts I had of 2025, arguably the most meta of any post I've ever had, was people arguing about the meaning of the word meaning. I'm not joking. Like hundreds of comments. So we have this phenomenon in our world, right? Which is like, we make up new stuff, we make up new words, and then we argue about the meaning of things, right? Like, wow, what's going on here? So I built a framework. I'm an analyst. Right. You can take the boy out of the analyst firm, but you can't take the analyst out of the boy. And I'm an analyst. And when I analyze this, I was like, there's this thing called this semantic pedanticism feedback loop. And there's actually incentives. That's the feedback loop. There are incentives to create new things. There's incentives for analysts to create new things. There's incentives for thought leaders to create new things because it creates the illusion that there's a new insight, that there's new value. And if you're an analyst and you create that illusion, oh, wow, there's this new thing called data literacy. I had no idea. I had no idea that we needed to train our end users on how to use our dashboards. Mind blown. I better go subscribe to an analyst room so I can get the insights I need in order to learn this new thing. Peel the onion, reality. Not so new. So I built this feedback, but what I've noticed, and I don't know why this is, but just the quibbling about the definitions of things, quibbling about meaning, quibbling about, you know, and introducing new words to describe old things or words that like are not net new. We just keep doing it. And it just seemed like it hit a fevered pitch last year. And I think it's a result of the paralysis, right? I think it's a result of the navel gazing. We love to navel gaze, right? Like we love to look inwards. And the more we navel gaze, I think the more we are prone to quibble and split hairs on definitions of things. Because many of us at heart are librarians, right? We're classifiers of things. We're labelers of things. And when that's your job, well, you get passionate about it. And that hit an all-time high in 2025. I giggle. Like the argument about the meaning of the word meaning. True story, my friends. True story. I love it. All right. Top trend. Number 10. And this one, I didn't want to put this as number 10, and I didn't even want it to be on the list, but it's a trend. And it's a sad one. But it's real. And this is mid-career disruptions. I saw in 2025, wow. Maybe it's because I'm mid-career. This could be a little bit of, I'm close to late career, to be honest. But maybe this is a little bit of the kind of self-reinforcing nature of the algorithms, particularly LinkedIn, but not exclusively. But I saw a lot of folks this year who are, you know, mid to late career losing their jobs. And, you know, a lot of people are getting new jobs. A lot of people are taking new positions, and those are great things. That's awesome. But I saw a lot of people losing their jobs, right? And those same people who are, you know, probably reasonably well compensated, right? Because they're mid to late career. They've been doing this 20 years, right? Highly skilled, highly experienced, right? Highly experienced, where all of a sudden you're out of a job, right? You're a director of analytics. You're a senior manager of data governance. You're who knows, maybe even VP, where, you know, you're cruising along and your career is progressing, and then poof, you're out of a job. And for those folks, it's tough. It's tough because their wages are high. Their experiences are equally high, right? Their knowledge is equally high. But what I'm seeing is those people are struggling to get rehired quickly, and they're taking 6 months plus, upwards of a year to get rehired. And when they do get rehired, typically they're taking a lesser title with lesser pay, right? Now, I don't know what's going on here. I think this may be in part, of course, not entirely. But in part, I think this could be a result of AI. I don't know this to be true. I'm speculating here. So this is pure speculation, but could a early to mid-career professional plus AI equal these skills, or at least create the perception of equal skills to a late career person? Could you downsize, riff a late career person and get two mid-career people for the same price and more output? When you layer in AI, yeah, maybe you could, right? Maybe you could, maybe you can't. You'll never replace that experience. You'll never replace that knowledge. But could you create the perception, at least, you know, temporarily, could you create the perception that you could actually do better? Potentially. I don't know. This is pure speculation, friends. And I need to do a little bit more research here, and I need to do a little bit more talking at these events and talk to some of the folks who have been affected this way, or talk to some of the CDOs who have made a decision to downsize late career professionals. But it's certainly a trend that I've been noticing. It's something that I've been seeing. It's not one I want to report. It's not one that I'm happy about, of course. But it's out there. So what does that mean? Well, you know, what that means is that we need to disrupt ourselves before others disrupt us. So if you are mid to late career, you need to become invaluable. You need to become your team's AI expert. You need to become the networking fiend. You need to go to these events. You need to get engaged. You need to start writing Substack articles. You need to get out there and active on LinkedIn. Build your brand, right? Build your knowledge, build your skills, build your network. Work yourself into a situation where you have value that goes above and beyond the things that you are doing at work. Get involved in a local data community, whatever it is. Try to disrupt yourself, right? Find ways. If you're worried about being automated, then automate yourself. Do it to yourself before others do it to you. Build your own GPT. Go and copy and paste every email you've ever sent. Follow your corporate security and data guidelines, of course, but go build your own GPT. Digitize yourself, right? Find ways to improve your productivity and augment your productivity, right? Become seen as that overperformer within your organization. Doesn't necessarily protect you 100%, but it'll make you far more attractive the next time around. If you've got the AI skills, right? If you are out there building your network, if you were out there active in events, if you were doing all these things, right? It's gonna be far, far more difficult to make the choice to downsize you, and far easier to make the choice to bring you on if you are. And it's all about your value as a data professional. So a lot of things we can be doing, right? I know a lot of us who are late in our careers didn't want to be in this position, right? We didn't want to be in a position of having to learn new skills necessarily and having to go back to working 50 or 60 hours a week. But I'll tell you, my friends, when this happens, it's tough, particularly if you got kids in college, particularly if you're helping take care of older parents, particularly if you've got like mortgage payments, all of the things, healthcare payments, all these things. So my advice to you, my friends, is make yourself invaluable, but disrupt yourself. Disrupt yourself. Build your own GPT. I could go on. Contact me offline. We can brainstorm with it. We can brainstorm about it, because these are things that I think all of us, mid, early, late career need to be thinking about, because the AI is out there. Right. And I'm an AI optimist. I'm absolutely an AI optimist. And I think that in the long run, there will be more opportunities than we've ever had before. I think Jevons' paradox, this is the idea of induced demand. I think if we can figure out unstructured data, right? If we can figure out how to get our hands around this world, this probabilistic world of AI, I think there'll be greater demand for our services than there ever has been before. So I'm optimistic about AI. I'm optimistic about 2026. I'm optimistic about your job and about my job, but that doesn't mean we can sit on our laurels. We need to move. We need to grow. We need to develop. That to me is the ongoing story of 2026. So if you want to hear more about what's coming in 2026, tune in in 2 weeks to the CDO Matters podcast. With that, I bid adieu to 2025. It's been an okay year. I hope it's been a good year for you, my friends. I hope you've enjoyed the content we've produced here on the CDO Matters podcast. We're going to keep doing it all of 2026. I look forward to that. I look forward to seeing you on another episode sometime very, very soon. With that, bye for now.